Well, good morning, everybody. My name is Scott. I'm one of the pastors here. I am 39 years old. I'm a former graduate of Grand Valley State University as a history major, and I like long walks on the beach. Actually, I don't think that's true. I think I like sitting on the beach. So there's some moderately interesting information about me. I would love to learn some moderately interesting information about you. So if I haven't met you before, I would love to chat with you after the service. Just, you know, be brave and come up and say hey to me. I'm usually around right here, and so I would love to chat with you. Would love to meet you. If you have a Bible, I'd love to invite you to turn to John 4 or find it on any device you may have. I like that we use that word device instead of phones because it implies that like some of you are bringing in like desktop computers and like setting up shop, you know. But we've been dealing with this series that we call Secret Lives. And we started it a few weeks ago because we know that there are some things inside of us that we don't share. That we don't share with each other, that we don't really put in front of God, that we even sort of keep from ourselves, just these hidden things that we would love to stay hidden, things we hope nobody else really ever sees. But since we all deal with this, since every single one of us, like going on in the recesses of our mind is this whole other life, this whole other secret life, we realize that why don't we just talk about it? Why don't we just acknowledge it together as a church and say, listen, nobody's okay. We're all dealing with this, and we all have some kind of story inside of us. Let's talk together about the different things that happen to us when we live into that secret life. Let's talk together about the things that are going on inside of us and what we can do about those secret lives. Because as we're finding out, living into our secret lives, hanging on to our secret lives, is really not the best thing for us as human beings, for us in our relationship with other people, and specifically in our relationship with God. So that's what we're talking about in this series. That's what we're dealing with. And in John 4 today, we're going to meet a woman. We're going to meet a woman with a secret life. And Jesus has this sort of long conversation with her, this interesting conversation along the side of a well, right? So they're sitting along the side of a well. And it might not seem so at first, but I think that this conversation that Jesus and this woman have together really mirrors our own stories and our own interactions with our secret lives. So we're just going to hang out in this one story today. So if you have a Bible and want to keep that open, follow along. We'll be stopping and starting through there. We'll also have it up on the screen. So why don't we jump in right away in John chapter 4. And this is verse 4 that we're starting at. Now Jesus had to go through Samaria. And we're going to stop just right away with Samaria. Because I get that most of you don't have any kind of concept of where this is happening. This is in the Middle East, this is in Israel, and in Israel you have a few different regions. If you think about Israel, actually if you think about it like this, if you take the state of Michigan and you put your finger on Lansing and you draw a line straight up to the Mackinac Bridge, and then you go back to Lansing and you draw a line straight over to the Lake Michigan, that corner right there, that's about the size of the entire country of Israel. Right, it's small. You can drive up and down it in a few hours, right? And so, in this small country, there are a few different regions. In the north, you have what's called the Galilee. They call it that because the Sea of Galilee is up there, and people who live in the north tend to be these religious, good Jewish people, right? And then in the south, as you get close towards the south, you have some desert area which leads you down into Egypt and things like that. But in the south is mostly dominated by Jerusalem. We read about Jerusalem a lot. It's the capital city. It's where the temple is. Also populated by, you know, historically just good Jewish people. And then right in the middle, between these two areas of like-minded people, you have this region what's known as Samaria. And Samaria is not filled with necessarily good Jewish people, in part because generations ago, the entire nation of Israel was under siege by the Assyrian nation, and they took captive many of the best and brightest and took them away to a different land. And over time, they intermarried with these Jewish folks, and there became this thread in the history of the Jewish people of those who were connected to Assyrians and were no longer pure Jewish folks, and eventually they all moved back. And so you had this sort of half mix of people living in between the areas of good Jewish folks, and they just didn't get along. They looked at them as half-breeds, they looked at them as outsiders, and they had a lot of racial tension in between these two groups of people. And it's this old, old rivalry that went back for hundreds and hundreds of years between these two almost separate races that didn't really get along and like each other. They exchanged insults and even violence over the years. So most of the time, people just stayed away from each other. They just stuck to their own kind. And Jews, in particular, if they could help it, wouldn't even speak with these folks. They wouldn't talk to them. They wouldn't engage them. And Jewish rabbis, like Jesus, who is a recognized sort of religious teacher, would often just go around that whole area if they were moving north or south. Right, so if you were in the Galilee and making your way down to a festival in Jerusalem, you just go around Samaria as much as you could. Sometimes even almost doubling the length of your trip, which is not the way I like to do long distance traveling. It's as fast as I can. Nobody's stopping for a bathroom break. We're going to get there, right? But this was important enough to these people where they would go around. So let's continue. So Jesus had to go through Samaria. He came to a town in Samaria called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob has given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired as he was from the journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon, so it's the hottest point of the day. When a Samaritan woman came to draw water, Jesus said to her, "Will you give me a drink?" And the writer also notes his disciples, these guys who followed him around all the time, weren't there. They had gone into town to buy food. It was just Jesus and this woman. The Samaritan woman said to him, "You are a Jew and I am a Samaritan woman. How can you ask me for a drink?" And the writer wants to be clear, for Jews do not associate with Samaritans, which is a real nice way to describe this conflict. So this is the setup. The conversation that is about to take place here is set up by a few details. The first detail is just this backdrop of the tension between these two groups of people. It's one reason why this conversation shouldn't be taking place at all, right? Secondly, she's a woman, which in the first century, Jewish men, especially religious leader type men, did not speak to women in public who were not their family, who were not their wives or their mother or their daughter. In fact, many just really conservative, traditional Jewish men didn't speak to even their wife or their daughter in public at all. Like, you didn't speak to women in public. So that's the second reason this conversation should not be taking place. Third, it also takes place at noon, which, if you kind of see where they are, they're at this well, and this woman that the writer tells us came to draw water at noon. Getting water is usually the role of women in that culture. That's not so unusual. Women often went to the well together, and they would go, and they would help each other with their tasks. They drew water for the day from the well. They would chat about what's going on with their families and catch up together. Probably exchange some gossip. Did you hear about so-and-so over there at the Sullivan's house and what's happening? So that's sort of a cultural connecting point at the well. But nobody went at noon. Nobody went at the hottest part of the day to get out there and to fetch their water and to do all of these tasks. So what was she doing there? Right? This conversation shouldn't be taking place here at this time because of the time of day either. So hold on to that one. We're going to talk about that one. But finally, John tells us that they went to a particular well, a place called Jacob's Well. Now, if you look and sort of do some of the archaeology, Jacob's Well is a half a mile outside of this town called Sychar. The city has a well that's much closer than this. But here we are, a half a mile into the desert, in the middle of the day, at the hottest part of the day, outside of town, And Jesus takes a moment alone to engage this person. So let's keep reading, and we'll see how this conversation begins to unfold. Jesus answered her, right? She had said, hey, Jesus said, can you draw me some water? And she said, I don't think we should be having this conversation. And then he answers her with this completely out of left field response to the conversation they're having about water. He says, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that asks you for a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. Weird response, right? So here's what I have to understand about how Jesus is talking. Jesus must be inferring something specific here. Like, Jesus is seemingly having his own kind of conversation in this moment. He's inferring that this woman is looking for something that someone can give her, right? If you knew, you would have asked and they would have given you, right? He's inferring that she is searching for something deeper, right? And he proposes that whole other kind of conversation about something much deeper. And he starts talking about living water. You are searching for something. And if you knew who I was, that's what we would be talking about right now. You would have asked me for something. She responds, sir, the woman said, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Where can you get this living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob, who gave us this well and drank from it himself, as did also his sons and his livestock? So again, their conversation, I don't know if you've ever had a conversation where you're talking over here and they're talking over here and you just can't quite get it. That's what this whole thing feels like to me for her, right? And so either she's confused, which is likely, or she knows exactly what he's talking about and she's trying to steer the conversation back to a different direction. I wonder if she's actually avoiding this conversation that Jesus starts in on at a really deep level. Jesus infers that she must be searching for something that someone can give. She's like, yeah, but, you know, this is a deep well, don't you think? Like, where are you going to get this? And you don't have a bucket. Let's find you a bucket, right? She's deflecting all over the place with these really practical, like, parts of the conversation. I wonder if she just doesn't want to have the conversation that Jesus seems to want to be having. So Jesus answers her, everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water I give them will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give them will become in them a spring of water welling up to eternal life. The woman said, sir, give me this water so I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water. So Jesus looks at this woman, and what does he see? Right? He doesn't necessarily see a Samaritan. He doesn't necessarily see a woman, one who's probably running away from something or hiding from other folks, although he knows that that's probably true. When Jesus looks at her, he sees this searching, right? This longing, this consistent and constant question inside of her that she's searching for something. And you see, what Jesus wants to talk about with this woman is this true longing and searching that honestly is at the heart of every single human being. Every single person, every single one of you, every single one of your neighbors. I don't care if you're a fourth grader or 45 years old, it's the same for every person. A longing that wants to be satisfied. A searching endlessly for a drink that will quench that thirst. Once and for all. Jesus wants to talk about something that everyone is searching for, every single person, and very simply, it's this, right? It's a longing to be known and loved for who we really are, right? A longing to be known and loved for who you really are. I don't care if you're in elementary school, I don't care if you're a college graduate, I don't care if you're a grandparent. Every single person has a longing to be known and loved for who they really are. This woman has it, and Jesus knows it because it's the longing of every person. That's why this story starts to begin to mirror our journey and mirror these things inside of us that turn into our secret lives. We give this longing all kinds of names. right? We attach all kinds of different metaphors to it. It's, for some of us, it's just the search for home or a yearning to belong or just someone to notice me. Or maybe we say, it's me trying to find myself. I don't know if you've ever heard the story of Christopher McCandless. He labeled this longing as a search for adventure, right? And a search to find himself. And there's a great book and movie, actually, entitled Into the Wild. John Krakauer wrote the book. But really the story about Christopher McCandless is that after he graduated college in 1990, he traveled across the North American continent. He sold all of his possessions. He burned whatever money he had left, and he hitchhiked to Alaska in April of 1992. And there he set out on an old mining road with really few supplies, and his goal was to just live minimally off the land and find himself in the great Alaskan wilderness. Unfortunately, Christopher's search for an answer to that longing led him to a lonely and distraught ending. On September 6, 1992, his body was discovered by hunters just outside of Denali National Park, and he had died inside this bus, this rusting bus number 142, that really served as his shelter. And taped to the door was a note that he had scrawled on a page from a novel he had brought with him, and this is what the note said. "Attention, possible visitors. SOS. I need your help. I am injured, near death, and too weak to hike out of here. I am all alone. This is no joke. In the name of God, please remain to save me. I am out collecting berries close by and shall return this evening. Thank you, Chris McCandless. August? Question mark." From a cryptic diary that they found amongst his possessions, it appeared that he had been dead for almost 19 days. And when his body was flown out of the wilderness into the hospital, the autopsy determined that he weighed 67 pounds and his body had almost no fat whatsoever. And the possible cause of his death was starvation. So McCandless was looking for something. He was longing for something. He was searching for something. And that search led him out to a different way of living that nobody else knew about him. And ultimately, cost him everything. We call this longing by lots of different names. We engage this longing in lots of different ways. The metaphor that Jesus chooses to use with this particular woman is the search for living water. Right? A water that will quench our thirst, that will quench this longing that we have to be known and loved for who we are. Some of us head out and escape everything, trying to find an answer to that longing. Some of us look for the answer in romance, or in our work, or in relationships, or entertainment, or wealth, or power, or just for a feeling. We chase all of these sorts of things. And for a brief moment, they all seem to deliver exactly what we're looking for, but it usually doesn't last. We drink from that kind of water, and an hour or two later, we find ourselves thirsty again. We have to get up tomorrow and do it all over again to try to quench that thirst inside of us. I would imagine that Chris McCandless thought he had found the answer to his longing, this desire to leave everybody behind and find himself in the wilderness. And I would imagine for a time it felt like this is what I've been searching for my entire life. But eventually, it's what ended his life. So I think Jesus knows that this woman is searching for something, just like the rest of us, searching to be known and loved for who we really are. But instead of letting her go down any one of these roads that I just mentioned, roads that will only leave her unhappy, roads that will only leave her distraught and scrawling out an SOS message when it's finally at a dire circumstance, instead, he offers her an invitation to find the thing she's been looking for her entire life, to be known and to be loved for who she really is. So this weird, like seemingly like mystical, cryptic conversation where they don't seem to be like on the same page, Jesus is beginning here in this conversation to simply just cut through all the baloney. right? To just work around all of the deflection and all of the distractions she's trying to do and simply just get at the heart of what's really happening inside of her, says, I want to have a conversation with you about your longing. And the problem with this woman is with probably each and every one of us, for certain with me, is that she has all these walls built up that she doesn't want to let other people into. Especially this Jewish rabbi who is getting close to this longing that she's trying to keep secret. Jesus has to find a way to get through these defenses. And he does. And he does it by asking a question that when he does it feels really rude when he says it. So listen to this in verse 16. He told her, go and call your husband and come back. So again, they were having a water conversation. Jesus is trying to get at the heart of her, of what's going on in her longing and her searching. She's talking about buckets and depths of wells, and then Jesus just turns the corner and goes, go call your husband and come back. I have no husband, she replied. Again, she's trying to deflect a little bit. She's very practical, like, no, I don't have a husband, so let's talk more about this well, right? But instead, Jesus says to her, you are right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you have had five husbands, and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have said is quite true. I would imagine that if Mary, Jesus' mother, was with him during this conversation, right, she'd be like, don't say that out loud. Like, this is like the parent's worst nightmare. You're walking around the grocery store with your, you know, four-year-old who's just now becoming really hyperverbal and just naming everything they see. And you run into a person where something might stand out about them and you're fearful your child's just going to point at it and name it, right? Did Jesus' mom not teach him, don't point and name things like that? Like, that's what's happening in this conversation, right? But here's what I think he's doing, because I've seen Jesus do this with others, and I have seen him do it with me all the time. I think what he's doing is he's calling into the light something that she is hiding. He says, all right, this thing that you are trying to keep behind a wall, that you're trying to keep kind of in your secret life, that you're trying to hide, I just want to drag it right out, and let's point at it, and let's talk about it. Like, that's what I think he's doing in there, this secret inside of her that really actually points to this longing to be known and to be loved for who she really is. Because I would imagine, if what Jesus is saying is true, that this woman must carry with her shame and embarrassment and rejection. A lot of things that we might call brokenness, because of this series of relationships that have never worked out. This husband after husband after boyfriend after boyfriend. And my guess is she does everything in her life to deflect everybody from a conversation about this. This is the conversation she's trying to ignore. She's trying to avoid having the exact conversation Jesus is having with her at this moment. Think about it. She's completely reoriented her daily routine to avoid conversation, right? Imagine, she's gone to great lengths to avoid the other women in her city, in her village, who might know this thing about you, and you worry perhaps they even talk about it behind your back when you're not around. She's like, I just want to avoid all of that. She's walked a half a mile out of the city into the desert in the middle of the day to make sure she's not going to run into anybody else, trying to avoid dealing with these kinds of questions that, if you're her, probably feel like an accusation, right? And then this Jewish rabbi shows up, who you assume probably thinks of you as nothing more than a dog, and starts in on you about this secret life you've had, about the six men that have been in her life, about the one conversation you never want to have with anybody else. I mean, don't we all have that? We all have one conversation we hope we never have with anybody else. And yet, this one conversation that she doesn't want to have is, in fact, the one conversation that, if you don't have, will keep her stuck in her secret life. It's the one conversation that will forever keep her from addressing her deepest longing to be known and loved for who she really is. And if you don't allow yourself to be known, you'll never allow yourself to be loved. You cannot be loved if you are not known. So my wife and I, we turned 17 in a couple of weeks. And just feels like I never thought we'd be teenagers again, but here we are, right? And so a couple of years ago, I remember this at our anniversary dinner, we just had this conversation about things in our life that you don't know about me, right? Let me tell you something about me that I know you don't know about me. And I'm not going to tell you what those was. So, I said it to her. I'm like, tell me something about you that I don't know about you. And doesn't that seem crazy? Like, after 15 years of doing life together as husband and wife, like, there's still something about me that you don't know. But I would imagine that that's true for all of us, right? The funny thing is that it's actually probably pretty easy to say to the person, there's something you don't know about me because it's true. That even those close to us, even those who we want to love us the most, who we want to be most connected to, we still keep things from them. There's still things about us that they don't know. So it's worth the practice of having, tell me something about yourself that I don't know, kinds of conversations with your spouse or with your parents, you know, with your kids. What's something about you that I don't know? And those, you know, I even say that and your blood pressure might rise a little bit, right? Because those feel like the riskiest kinds of conversations to have. I mean, because if they really knew this thing about me that they don't know, would they still love me? Would they still treat me the same? Would they walk away from me? If the deepest longing in our heart is to be known and loved for who we are, then the choice to allow ourselves to be known is one of the most vulnerable things that we can do. In fact, it might be easier for you to stop a stranger on the street and say, let me tell you something about me you don't know, right? Because you don't have to live with them. You don't have to engage with them. You're never going to see them again. But we have to know. If we're going to get out of our secret lives, if this woman is going to leave this isolated world she lives in, right? We have to know that even when those things are exposed and brought into the light, we can still be loved. So Jesus goes right to the thing in her life, the thing that she most wants to keep in the dark, the thing that she most wants to hide from everybody. And this seemingly rude question that Jesus asks is getting at the root of her problem. To drag it out into the light, something she'd rather keep hidden, because he wants her to know that she is loved for who she is. And she can't know that unless she is known for who she is. Every single one of us longs to be known and loved for who we really are. And as long as we hide who we are, as long as we keep ourselves from being known, we're never going to experience the kind of love that he wants her to know about. You know, if you think about this woman, there's probably a good chance that she hasn't had 5 husbands or live-in boyfriends by her own choice. I mean, if you think about the culture of the time, a first century Israeli woman didn't really have a lot of power, right? Didn't really have a lot of advocacy and agency to string together a line of marriages and divorces. In fact, more than likely in that culture, she was not able to divorce anybody. You know, for Jesus to say you've had 5 husbands means that 5 times people have said, I'm done with you, whether she wanted them to or not. 5 separate times she has heard somebody say, I'm leaving you. I no longer care for you. Something about you, I'm not interested in it anymore. So more than likely she has had experiences in her life of men who have used her and then tossed her aside. So it's more likely that the secret she's keeping is not about 5 or 6 men in her life. The secret she's keeping is the sense that deep down she's not worth keeping. Right? Like we said last week, it's not hard for us to admit mistakes. What's hard for us is the thought that those mistakes actually reflect who we really are and they say something about our character. And for her, her character seems to be, I'm not worth having. that there's some fatal flaw in me that keeps me from being accepted and means I'll always be rejected again and again and again. And maybe at this point she even believes she deserves it. No, it makes sense. This is just who I am. That she believes she has become fundamentally unlovable. And she's with guy number six because there's something inside of her that still longs for it, that still reaches out for it. So she goes back to that well again and again and again. I mean, you and I couldn't tell her how that story is going to end too. She just keeps looking for somewhere, someone who will answer the longing to be known and loved and to be worth keeping. I love how author Henry Nouwen sort of writes about this in his book, Life of the Beloved. He says, over the years, I have come to realize that the greatest trap in our life is not success or popularity or power, but self-rejection. When we have come to believe in the voices that call us worthless and unlovable, then success and power are easily perceived as attractive solutions. The real trap, however, is self-rejection. When everybody seems to tell you that you are unlovable or unworthy, then it seems like the only way for me to find value is to accomplish something, is to achieve something. He goes on to say, as soon as someone accuses me or criticizes me, as soon as I am rejected, left alone, or abandoned, I find myself thinking, well, that proves once again that I am a nobody. My dark side says I am no good. I deserve to be pushed aside, forgotten, rejected, and abandoned. Self-rejection is the greatest enemy of the spiritual life because it contradicts the sacred voice that calls us the beloved. Being the beloved constitutes the core truth of our very existence. Self-rejection is the greatest enemy of our spiritual life, right? Not doubt, not sin, not a mistake, but self-rejection. This belief that I am not worthy to be loved and worthy to be known. And the reason Jesus keeps bringing up the men in her life is because he wants to talk about the darkest place in her life, this place of self-rejection. These men are just a symptom of the real sickness, the real secret that she's carrying, that she doesn't think she can be loved. And she's isolating herself. She's going out in the middle of the day away from her community because she just believes she is unlovable. And so she does what we all do when things get a little too real. She changes the subject. In verse 19, "Sir," the woman said, "I can see you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you Jews claim that the place we must worship is in Jerusalem." So she wants to talk about religion now. She wants to get religious with Jesus, right? She wants to talk about the rules. Jesus gets real close to home, and then I think she redirects the conversation in a whole different direction. And we do that, right? We like to talk about religious things to avoid what's happening about in our lives for real. Jesus is not interested in talking about religious things. Rarely, actually, is he interested in doing that. He is only interested in this entire conversation around the core of her secret life. I mean, the times where I've had conversations with people about religious things, how the church should be doing something or shouldn't be doing something, or the right way of participating in my faith versus the wrong way of doing it, I know we're actually avoiding some deeper conversation, something else underneath there. We're avoiding these longings and secrets that Jesus wastes no time in getting to with this woman. So she takes the conversation up here and tries to avoid what's really happening. We all do that. We protect our secrets, right? We hide because what will happen if they knew? I mean, can I just tell you something about your secrets? They're not that interesting. They're also not surprising. I mean, I have had countless conversations with people, many of you, and I know my own life, and there is nothing that you can tell me that would shock me. There are very few things in your life where I can't say, oh yeah, I know so-and-so deals with that and so-and-so, and I deal with that too. Right? That thing that you are afraid will change the other person's opinion of you is actually the thing that when you tell us, we can suddenly relate to you more. We start to understand you more and go, oh, I mean, I saw this bit here and this bit here, but now it all makes sense. I get why this is the way you are. This is what you do. And suddenly I'm more connected to you. I feel like I know you better and you feel more known to me. Anytime I've told somebody a secret about myself, I have always found myself feeling more connected to them, more known by them. Anytime I've had that, let me tell you something about me that you don't know, conversation with my wife, we fall more in love with each other every time. So here's how Jesus responds in verse 21. Woman, Jesus replied, believe me. She's having this religious conversation. Believe me, there is a time coming when you will worship the Father, not the Lord, not God, not religious language, the Father, neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Yet a time is coming, and it has now come, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. The whole of your person, the spirit and in truth, everything about you. For they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in the spirit and in truth. What God really wants, he doesn't care about what mountain you're on. God wants you to bring your whole self to the table, the whole authentic self, to experience him with all of that. The woman said, I know that the Messiah called Christ is coming. When he comes, he will explain everything to us. Finally. This whole time, from the very beginning of the conversation, Jesus has named and understood this. This woman is searching for something, and she finally names it. She finally admits what Jesus knows from the beginning of the conversation. I've been looking for someone. I know that a Messiah is coming, and he'll make this all make sense. I know that somebody is coming to put my life together in a way that I can understand and make sense and feel fully known and fully loved. I know that that person is coming, and I've been longing for that. Where he will explain everything and I no longer have to hide. I'm just waiting for this to show up in my life. After this whole weird, sideways, deflected conversation, she finally nails it. I am looking for something. I'm looking for someone where I don't have to hide and this will all make sense. Then Jesus declared, I, the one speaking to you, I am he. You know that person you're waiting for? It's right here. That longing inside of you where it all will make sense and you no longer have to hide, where you feel known and loved for who you really are, that's what I'm doing. That's what I'm here for. Because you can't feel loved fully unless you are known fully. So this week, I want to invite you into a little practice. Sometimes I do this when I read the Bible. I want to invite you to read this story in the Bible from John chapter 4 that we just walked through. And I want to ask you to do a couple of things while you do it, right? So here's what I want you to do. First, just find a quiet spot and imagine yourself sitting at the well with Jesus. I know that feels a little weird for some of us, right? But just use your imagination, stretch your imagination muscle, and sit at the well with Jesus, and imagine you're having this conversation with him the way he has had it with her. And ask yourself these sorts of questions. What does he say to you? What secret does he bring up that keeps you from being known and loved for who you really are? What's the conversation he has with you, not with this woman? Because he's not going to bring up the five husbands and the one year. He's not doing that. He's having a different conversation with you. What does he bring up? And then ask yourself this question. What step does Jesus invite you to take away from that secret that keeps you hiding? And how will you respond? What does he bring up? What does he invite you to step into? And what choice will you make? So do that, John 4. Maybe you got to do it more than once. Maybe you do it every day this week. I don't know, but imagine yourself in this particular conversation. I also want to invite you to consider taking part in our baptism service later this month. We do baptism because it serves as a moment in our life where we commit to stop hiding. We commit to allowing God to fully know us so we can be fully loved. It's this moment in your life that you can lean on when you have a desire to run, when you have a desire to hide and to deflect, and instead remember what's true about you, that through the experience of baptism, there's a God who fully knows you and loves you. If you've had that moment in your life, if you want to mark that moment, or if God's leading you to that moment, don't ignore it. Let's talk about it together so we can celebrate this thing that is true about God, that he wants us to be fully known and fully loved. So here's the question to end with today. What could change in your life if that were true? What might your life look like if you knew you were fully known and fully loved for who you really are, not for what you've done or what other people say about you? You're not your secrets. You are God's beloved child. And the more you keep hiding them, the more you live into your secret life, the more you keep yourself from being known and being fully loved for who you really are. So let's take a step forward to allow ourselves to be known. Let's pray. God, I'm grateful that you are a God that cuts through the deflections in our conversations, the excuses and the but lords and the I don't know and I'm not good enoughs. And God, I'm grateful that you are the kind of God that says, I don't even want to have those conversations. The kind of God that says, I'm not interested in your conversations about religion. I want to talk about what's at the heart of who you are. And so, God, I pray that you do that with us this week, that we would be people who find space to engage in that conversation with you, that we imagine ourselves sitting at the well alongside of you. God, give us courage to face that, because those are fearful conversations. They feel risky and scary. And God, would you show us what we're keeping from being fully known? God, I also pray for opportunities where we can have, let me tell you something about myself that you didn't know, conversations. Maybe it's in our families or with our spouses, or maybe it's with close friends, or God, even if it's with a stranger, God, help us to walk through this life knowing that when we are fully known, we are fully loved. Thank you for your son who continues to remind us of this message. And it's in his name today we pray. Amen.